Welcome to Fascinating Ohio on All Sides with Anna Staver, an hour where we share stories about Ohioans whose dedication and drive, passion and perseverance can inspire us all. Today we begin with a story that's both fascinating and quirky. A restaurant in Toledo, Ohio that's home to more than 1,000 autographed hot dog buns. Buns signed by former presidential candidates, movie stars, music legends, and more. Jim Beard has worked at Tony Paco's restaurant for nearly 20 years and serves as its unofficial historian. Welcome to All Sides, Jim.
Well, hot dog. It's good to be here, Anna. You see what I did there, right?
Oh, I do. I love a good pun. And maybe a good bun.
Touché.
So, celebrities, dignitaries, musicians, they've all left their mark by signing a hot dog bun. But it got started with Burt Reynolds in 1972. Why did he sign the very first hot dog bun?
Well, that's an interesting story. He was in town doing summer stock, a play, The Rainmaker, and the then owner, Nancy Paco, the daughter of the original Tony, was a fan of Burt Reynolds, like many ladies were at that time. He was right on the cusp of becoming just huge. It was right before Deliverance came out. She invited him over to the restaurant and didn't think that he would, you know, come accept the invitation. And lo and behold, he showed up and he brought the whole crew with him. So this party began at the restaurant that went into the wee hours of the night. And at the end, they said, "Burt, we really want you to sign something. We, you know, a napkin, a menu. We need to prove to people that you were actually here." And Burt grabbed a bun and signed it, and the tradition began. And I have to tell you, there might have been a little alcohol involved in that decision.
I didn't know you could sign a hot dog bun. I assume it was a Sharpie or some kind of marker.
Yeah, in 72, I'm not really sure. Unfortunately, it was a real hot dog bun, and that bun is long gone. It disintegrated decades ago. They didn't think to treat it or anything like that. They continued using real buns for a while. I don't know if they let them go stale a little bit. But yeah, it's kind of a challenge. But what happened by the end of the 70s, they realized that they just couldn't keep doing that anymore. And they went out to a local Toledo man who was able to fashion an artificial hot dog bun out of plastic and styrofoam that make it look just like a real bun. And since that time, since roughly about 1980 up to this very moment, that is what we use if a celebrity comes in. And believe me, it's a lot easier to sign a plastic bun than it is a real bun.
I would think so. Have you ever got Burt Reynolds to re-sign one?
Yeah, so what happened is that he and Nancy became very good friends, and if he was ever in the area, he would actually stop back in. So we actually have two of the artificial buns signed by Burt on later occasions.
So it's a presidential year, in case you hadn't noticed.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, what politicians, what big names do you have from the political arena on the wall?
So we're very proud to say that we have 7 U.S. presidents.
Oh, wow.
Presented. Yeah. 5 of which are literally the last 5, including our current sitting president. Reagan, but we do have Nancy Reagan, and we don't have Bush Sr., but we do have Barbara Bush. But we have, starting with Ford, we have Ford and Carter and Clinton and Bush Jr. and Obama and Trump and Biden.
Oh, my goodness. You have got a lot of presidential signatures. Do you have any governors? Has Governor Mike DeWine signed one?
Yes, Mike has signed ones. And we do have a few others from before him, if I'm not mistaken. A lot of mayors, senators, council people, all sorts of anybody comes to Tony Paco's.
How do you decide that somebody is bun worthy?
Yeah, This is a difficult one at this time. It is very challenging. I mean, obviously, if it's a name that we immediately recognize,
Right.
that's an automatic, you know.
The president of the United States feels like an
Yeah,
obvious
right. You
choice.
know, but I'll tell you, we have so little room left on the walls right now. I mean, we've been doing this since 1972, and we're kind of running out of room. So, if somebody comes in and they say, "Hey, I'd like to sign a bun," a restaurant manager is going to ask them what it is that is their claim to fame. And if it's easy enough to jump on Google and find something, and you know, pretty much almost anything at all. But then we also now caution them that although they may get to sign one, it may not get to go up on the wall. Yeah, we have to be a little choosy these days.
I gotcha. It makes sense, or you need to expand to a bigger location.
Well, maybe we've been in this location for 92 years. The original
Okay.
pack was 92 years here in the old Hungarian neighborhood of Toledo. So yeah, we do have other locations in the greater Toledo area, and some of the buns go there too, especially if somebody stops in at one of those locations. But the main collection, the names that a lot of people are going to recognize, are all here at Front Street in Toledo.
Yeah, you've got rock musician Pat Benatar, Mr. T, Billy Joel. I mean, big names have come and had a hot dog at the very least and signed these.
Yeah, it's really amazing, and there's really no rhyme or reason the way they're up on the walls. So we like to think of it as a treasure hunt that people come in and just start looking, and we say you never know who you're going to stumble across. And even if you might not recognize the name, a lot of the more current ones will have a little tag that tells you something about them. So you may see like the yo-yo champion of the world. You may not recognize their name, but you may go, "Oh my gosh, that's really cool, the yo-yo champion of the world."
Yeah, Tony Pacos is also famous for its Native Son actor, Jamie Farr. He put the restaurant and its Hungarian hot dogs on the map when he starred in the hit TV show MASH. And yeah, he's got a signed hot dog bun up on the wall.
Hey,
He's
incidentally, if you're
got
ever in
he's
Toledo,
got
Ohio, on a Hungarian side of town, Tony Pacos, greatest Hungarian hot dogs with chili peppers, 35 cents, and a cold beer.
Oh,
Sorry,
kudos. See, you have the actual quote there. That's wonderful.
yeah, my producers are amazing. But yeah, what kind of publicity did that give the business at the time? I mean, MASH was a huge television show.
I'll be honest, it took a few years because that's the first reference, and that was in 1976. That's the last episode of season four. And it took a few more mentions. We have six mentions altogether, six different episodes. It took a few more mentions before people started to realize that it was a thing, and really importantly, that it was a real place.
Ah, that they hadn't made it
Not
up for the
that's,
show.
yeah, there's a lot that's made up for the show, like Crabapple Cove for Hawkeye. But by the end of the decade, going into the 80s, the show lasted until 83. Then people started to really figure it out. And Anna, I have to tell you, it's amazing what some free publicity on one of the greatest television shows of all time will do. To this day, although it's starting to die off somewhat because the younger generations are not quite aware of the show, we still have thousands of people who come in, and that's the first thing out of their mouths. I'm here because of Klinger.
I will say the price is probably higher than 35 cents nowadays.
I will also admit, yes, it is. But I tell you, we give it every penny's worth here.
So, what makes a Hungarian hot dog as opposed to a regular hot dog?
It's a great question. Our founder actually was serving a Hungarian sausage called kolbasz, and that's sort of the Hungarian equivalent to Polish kielbasa. And he got an idea to start serving it like a hot dog. He split it down the middle and put it in a bun. His wife, Rose, had a chili sauce recipe. And everything kind of came together. He was charging 5 cents. We were talking about 35 cents when Klinger talked about it, which was supposed to be the 1950s. But he was charging 10 cents for the full large sausage. But this was in the middle of the Depression, and people were asking him, can you cut it in half and maybe just charge a nickel? So Tony got the idea of combining all of that into a hot dog. A Coney dog was really a popular thing at that time, and he charged a nickel for it. And it was one of those really wonderful things where everything came together. Tony was selling a lot of hot dogs, but the people in the community were getting a good filling meal for a very inexpensive price. And I love it because together they all got through what was a very, very rough time for everybody. The business was a success, and then people were, able to eat for very little money.
But you guys offer a whole wide menu just beyond the Hungarian hot dog. Do you have a favorite dish on the menu that isn't the hot dog?
I do actually. So we have a wonderful Hungarian chicken and dumplings called chicken paprika, which some people call chicken paprikash, which is sort of an Americanization of paprikas. But it's a really, really wonderful, filling, old world kind of dish. And I always tell people who ask me about it that I try not to eat it too much because I don't ever want to become tired of it.
Oh, that does sound really appetizing. I'm gonna have to make a trek up there and see
Yes,
the
you
hot
will, because
dogs, get the one.
we'll have you sign a hot dog bun,
Oh, I didn't. Oh my gosh, I didn't
right?
know I would be hot dog bun worthy.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah, you have your own show, so that qualifies.
Qualifies
Now,
to sign. Maybe
whether or
not on
not it
the
gets
wall.
up on
Maybe
the
not at the
wall.
Met. Yeah. Maybe not the main location. Maybe one of those satellite locations.
Okay.
So, have you been there when a celebrity's come in and ever signed one of the buns?
Yeah, a few. It doesn't happen as much as it used to. The nature of celebrity-ness has really changed over the years. And the bigger name people don't really go out into communities anymore when they perform or they speak or whatever. But I've met Jamie himself on three separate occasions here at the restaurant. And a few other, oh, we'll talk about politicians. When then Governor Mike Pence was running along with Donald Trump, Mike actually showed up one Tuesday afternoon at the restaurant. We were swarmed by Secret Service men. We had no idea who the heck was coming in, and the next thing we know that Governor Pence came in and he walked up to the counter like everybody else and got his hot dogs and sat down and ate and then kind of walked around and, introduced himself to people. It was a very nice visit.
Also, recently, a TikTok user named Sniping for Dom, he has nearly 900,000 followers, and he posted a rave review. I don't know if he signed a hot dog bun at the time, but I guess there's a whole new generation online who might be discovering your.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting thing that you bring up there. I'm talking about the nature of celebrities. So, what has shifted is that we get people who, like Dom, walk in and say, "Hey, I have 500,000 followers on YouTube or TikTok. Can I sign a bun?" And we've realized that that is who our celebrities are these days. It's not necessarily Robert Plant jumping off stage and getting in a limo and coming over here anymore. So it'll be our new celebrities like that.
We're also looking for fascinating Ohioans for future shows. If you know someone or you are someone, you can email allsides@wosu.org, or you can find us on Instagram and on Facebook. So if someone makes a special trip to Tony Paco's to grab a bite to eat and see the hot dogs, what are your hours? When are you open?
So Monday through Saturday, we open at 10:30 a.m. in the morning, and then we are actually open till 9 p.m. Monday through Thursday, and then Friday and Saturday until 10 p.m. On Sundays, we open an hour later at 11:30 a.m. and we close it at 9 a.m. p.m. Whoa, yeah, I don't want to say that wrong.
My final question for you is, have you ever thought of making a trivia game, like questions and then having people hunt around the store for the buns?
That's a really fun idea. Speaking of trivia games, there was once a MASH trivia game that was set up like Trivial Pursuit, And we actually are in there as a question.
Oh my
And we have
gosh.
an example of it hanging up on the wall. So yeah. Until that time, we invite people to come in and sort of make up their own games. And we have seen that happen. And like I said, if you treat it like a treasure hunt, I think you're really going to be amazed. You're going to see names that you don't recognize, but they're still cool. And then you're going to see quite a lot of names that you will definitely recognize.
It's kind of like a Where's Waldo?
Yeah, very much so. You can play Where's Jamie?
That was Jim Beard from Tony Paco's restaurant in Toledo. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, and don't forget that invitation.
I will not. Coming up, how one man is working to revitalize his neighborhood, one home at a time. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Fascinating Ohio on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. What does it take to revitalize a neighborhood? Jim Sweeney of Franklinton has decided to try that out, buying and transforming houses on his block, starting with a newly opened tavern in his home. Jim, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you very much for having me.
You took inspiration from a street in Austin, Texas, called Rainy Street. What was it about Rainy that made you want to transform Walnut here in Columbus?
It's actually kind of really surprising, the similarities between Rainy Street and Walnut Street in Columbus. Just down to like the people that live there, kind of an immigrant population. I always make the case that Franklinton and lots of neighborhoods in Columbus and Central Ohio actually have what I would describe largely as an immigrant population. That is to say, people who came up from Appalachia to work in the factories that grew up around in the 40s and 50s and 60s, and then closed in the 80s and 90s. And in Austin, it's a very Rainy Street has a large Mexican population and small houses, lots of them that. On Rainy Street, they rezoned it. The whole street, the city expected the growth that they're seeing now, and so they rezoned the street to accept bigger buildings. And then 2008 happened, so that didn't occur. The bigger buildings didn't show up, but so there was this moment into which jumped a few bar owners, particularly a woman named Bridget Dunlap, actually, bought one of the houses and rented three more and opened four bars, like in Austin style, with, you know, guitar bars. And then other bar owners jumped in and rented the rest of the block. And the weird similarities are that, that Rainy Street, I measured all this on Google Earth, is about the same length and dimensions. I think I'm a planner by training, so I'm always thinking in terms of geography and sort of wayfinding and placemaking. And it's about the same size and dimensions of Walnut Street. And then I got curious. I measured the distance from between Rainy Street and the Texas Capitol building. And it's exactly the same distance that Walnut Street is from the Ohio Capitol building, 0.81 miles.
And so you decided to start with a house of yourself. And you've turned it into something called Sweeney's Walnut Street Tavern.
Mm-hmm. I did, yeah. The idea for Walnut Street is that it's a very little known street. Actually, lots of people who spent lots of time in Franklinton didn't even know it was a street. It's narrow. The houses are mostly gone. There's only 13 left, all in, and it looks like an alley. And people that had been there for years had no idea it was there. So, it's you know a kind of a gettable street. The houses are small and functionally obsolete. Most of them were vacant. They look abandoned. I got to know some of the neighbors, all the neighbors, actually. It's not that hard in such a small place. And yeah, they showed some interest in selling their houses for the right price. And so I talked to my friend Blake Compton, who ended up buying one of the houses on the street, about an idea to convert these houses into something other than residential, something more than residential.
Like, right.
We're not precluding residential as a choice. You know, we'd like to see some apartments mixed in, but also put the houses to uses that would be more economically feasible going forward. They're small, you know, they're very old. You know, most had plumbing like retrofitted.
Mm.
And so they're very challenging. And so it's not likely that anybody's going to actually try to save these houses for any kind of economic or with any kind of economic confidence that they're going to be worthwhile. And so what I thought was, what if we repurpose them into things that do have an economic future in order to keep the houses? So as much as anything, Walnut Street's a historic preservation effort. And so we figured if we get enough, we could take some risks, of course. There's lots of that involved. But if we have enough, we can sort of create our own environment, sort of a arts district within an arts district. So dial it down a couple different levels and dial it down one more level to my own personal house that I was living in and do something that I think would be a contribution to the community, a place people can gather and hatch ideas and just build relationships that may not otherwise occur.
So you opened a bar called Sweeney's Walnut Street Tavern. It's at 500 West Walnut. It's a two-story building, but it's not particularly large, like you said. It's 750 square feet inside, has a front and back patio. How did you land on the raccoon for the logo? Because there's a cute little raccoon staring at me right now.
Yeah.
Not a live one.
No.
Logo
no,
one.
I didn't bring a live raccoon, although I have one in the backyard that's been popping up lately.
It's unofficial mascot.
Unofficial mascot, absolutely. His name is Lance.
Ah.
And named after Lance Robbins, the L.A. developer who bought the 400 West Rich buildings and converted them to art spaces and really launched the arts district thing. Passed away about 8 months ago. So, you know, we feel like maybe that little raccoon is like the spirit of Lance looking, you know, checking in on making sure his vision is being pursued. But, yeah, the raccoon is just, I've been talking to a lot of people about this. It wasn't ever, I'd never thought about the raccoon in the whole planning. It just kind of popped up. In the discussions with my designer, Andrew Lundberg, who came up with the logo. I went through Big Trek Productions, or Big Trek marketing firm in town. And Andrew designed the thing. And I just mentioned in a meeting early on, it's like, wouldn't it be cool if I had this picture of a raccoon that I like? I was like, and, you know, in a way, you know, somebody said to me the other day, raccoons own this neighborhood. They just let us be here because there are quite a few of them around. It's a lot of wildlife in Franklinton. It's pretty fun. And so Andrew came up with this really adorable, you know, logo, and we spiffed it up a little bit. I wanted the raccoon to look a little bit more menacing, and I didn't want it to be cute. I didn't want a Geico lizard, you know, being.
Yeah.
But it just worked out so well, and it's just such a
good. He kind of looks a little surly on the logo.
Exactly. That's it. I wanted him to look kind of Franklinton, a little bit, you know, a little edgy, a little like tougher than the rest, you know, a little bit survivors. Raccoons are survivors. You know,
yeah.
They've made it through this. You know, the flood well got built. Now we can be there, but they've been there the whole time. They have opposable thumbs. You know, there's amazing videos of them out there. They're just cute and cool.
Yeah, so you and your business partner, Blake, mm-hmm. and some investors have bought 13 houses along Walnut Street.
There are 13 houses.
Okay.
We bought 8.
Oh, you've bought 8 of the 13. Gotcha.
Yeah.
So what is the plan for the other 7?
Well, we've actually, we're looking at creative ideas. I mean, it has to be creative. I mean, it's just really, the challenges are these places are just so small,
mm-hmm.
and they're in such hard shape, and they don't meet modern building code by a long shot. So you have to adapt them and provide ADA accessibility, of course, and fire protection. And so the thought was combine where possible.
Mm.
In a way that keeps the houses looking like the old houses. We want it to be, again, a historic preservation effort. But it has to make economic sense because we really did pay market rate for these. Nobody was sort of like ripped off or like forced out or anything like that. These folks wanted to sell and we wanted to buy. And so there's a significant, like I said, there's a risk involved in investing in these. So there's a lot to spend on them. So combining them makes some sense, getting some efficiencies. They could share ADA bathrooms, share ADA ramps, where the fire separation issues become less so when they're combined into a single. And so we've actually been in front of the East Franklinton Review Board. Actually, I should say Blake has been in front of the East Franklinton Review Board because I'm actually on the East Franklinton Review Board. Yeah, I'm on everything. And already received the change of use permit for the cluster of three that we have. And we're going up back this month for the cluster of two. And what do we hope happens there? You know, I would love to see an environment where we have a range of sort of, how do I describe this?
Maybe a small cafe style.
Yeah, yeah, the cafe for sure. You know, I'd love to see a bike shop of some sort. Mm. You know, we are right at the hub of the regional bike network, which is substantial. I would like to be able to kind of own that, see more bikes rolling down the street. I think a record store, a bookstore. We have an excellent record store actually there now, Rich Street Records.
When I lived in Oregon, one of my favorite coffee shops, it was called Vero in Eugene, was in an old Victorian house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been a few interesting house conversions to other things. In Columbus, not so much in Columbus, other cities, but the ones in Columbus are always interesting. They're usually in much bigger houses.
Yeah.
And it makes better sense, more square footage for the effort. So these are particularly challenging. But this also makes them more intimate and more fun, you know?
Yeah. And do you hope it's sort of, what's it called? I'm trying to think of the right word, that you opening will let more people feel mm-hmm. comfortable mm-hmm. and it will sort of snowball. That's
snowball.
The word on itself.
That, we're counting on the snowball effect. Yes, we need it to work. We need to, they say, you know, when you're trying to develop, and my background's affordable housing, of course, and there's, which is development, which is building, and so I've been in many building and development conversations. How do you revitalize neighborhoods? How do you use affordable housing to do it in a just and humane way? And, you know, oftentimes, like, okay, well, if we build a house here, nobody's going to come here. If we build two, what if we build 40? You know, what if we make our own gravity? What if we pull people in because there's something really special and exciting about the place?
And it would have effects on the streets nearby and out and out mm-hmm. that if there's this really cool street with a record store and a bike shop and a coffee shop mm-hmm. and a bar and a this and mm-hmm. a that, like people would want to live near that location.
Yeah. Yeah, we think so. We're not actually having any trouble attracting development to the area. There's plenty planned. I would guess there's probably on the books now or being proposed or actually under construction. 300-400 units right now.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, as much as anything, that doing Walnut Street the way we're doing it is a response to that because we want to, it's essentially the last cluster of the old school houses in the oldest neighborhood in the city, east of Gift Street. So there's definitely development pressure on us.
Yeah.
Without some sort of creative solution, the houses will certainly be bought up and demoed.
So that it doesn't end up cookie cutter.
Yeah, exactly. We're trying to, in Franklinton, you know, we take a lot of pride in pushing back against the normal procedure of neighborhood development. Some might say gentrification, right?
Well, I mean, even if you look at German Village, we've got those undulating cobblestone sidewalks, mm-hmm. these quirky mm-hmm. buildings. Mm-hmm. There is an appeal to it looking the way that it looks.
Absolutely. Yeah. I expect that what we're doing, Blake and I and some others are doing, will be of immense benefit to those around us. So I'm hoping those around us might step up and actually do something to help us out. Not that they haven't, not that we've even asked, but it's about community. It's about people working together. And I mentioned developers. I'm actually friends and know most of them, and they're excited about this. They want this, and you know, they're listening to us when they're planning their projects, And so I think if we're all talking to one another, we can create an environment and still make what we need to make and not lose everything. But just make a really interesting place. What scares me, the nightmare I have is I wake up in 20 years and somebody says to me, oh, I wish I'd have known you were going to do that because I would have done this differently. And so we're trying to have those conversations now.
Yeah.
And we have a great, that's what this bar is intended to be, a place where people can come together and talk about the future and build relationships so we don't make bad moves along the way. We're not doing the cookie-cutter status quo moves. We're actually making more thoughtful moves in the neighborhood. There's a term for it called creative placemaking, right? And so that's where we'd like to engage in sort of the principles of creative placemaking, which are inclusivity, respect for history, walkability, all the kind of the modern sort of planning principles that people are now talking about, but didn't talk about in, you know, before the 90s.
Yeah, I didn't know that Franklinton was one of Columbus's oldest neighborhoods, settled in 1797.
Older than Ohio.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is as old as, or older than German Village, and you had no idea.
Oh, it's the first settlement. It was the first place that Europeans, I guess, came out and started building things. So, yeah, we take a lot of pride in that. Unfortunately, we were also the home of the flooding, and so a lot of buildings were damaged, many destroyed, many people killed in the flooding over the last century. But it also damaged the building and certainly the reputation. We're a very easily isolatable neighborhood, if that's a word. We're on the other side of the river, and if you take out bridges, we're kind of cut off. And that, you know, that creates an interesting sense of space, which before, when the reputation was so bad, it was made people very frightened to be there because it's a very clear sense of space. I mean, Franklinton's a neighborhood that doesn't roll into the next neighborhood. It's its own thing. Nothing against the neighborhood south, you know, on the south side. I love them. But, you know, I don't know where Marion Village starts and Hungarian Village ends or even German Village. So there's clearly defined boundaries, I think, is useful. It's part of placemaking. It's part of cognitive wayfinding. And it sends cues to people almost subconsciously of you're in this space. Here's how you feel. Here's how you get in. Here's how you get out. Here's what you do here. And I think we have this amazing opportunity in Franklinton now that we've kind of turned the corner on the reputation to provide things that this city might not otherwise be able to provide, this sort of, you know, several days long creative experience.
This is still, though, a largely residential area. So how are you working with the neighbors, you know, as you develop commercial real estate mm-hmm. within their residential neighborhood? Because I have to assume not everybody wants to live next to a bar.
Well, you need to come see it.
Okay.
When I say it's the last collection of the old houses, I mean that quite literally. And there are vacant lots everywhere. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been to Detroit? It's not like Detroit exactly.
But gotcha.
Imagine Detroit neighborhoods where most of them are just gone. Most of the houses in my part of the neighborhood, I say the eastern edge of the neighborhood, were wiped out in the 1913 flood. They floated away. They didn't bolt houses down. If the water got high enough, they'd float away.
Oh, my gosh.
And so, you know, and it was a terrible tragedy, and it happened again in 1959. But at that point, anybody who could get out got out, and the houses just continued to decline. And like I said, they're old, you know, functionally obsolete houses with lead paint, asbestos. It's really, really challenging. I did this with the Franklinton Development Association. We used to buy houses throughout the neighborhood and rehab them. It was extremely hard to do. We had to layer in several grants oftentimes to get them to a point where somebody could actually buy them after all the investment we made.
Yeah. I understand that you had a direct hand in the renovation and construction of 150 homes in that area. So a lot of work.
It's a, yeah, you know, I ran the FDA for 14 years at a board of directors, all residents of the neighborhood.
And that's Franklin Development Association, not Food and Drug Administration.
No, that's a different organization. Although I did have a sign on my, an article on my wall, a headline said FDA approves morning after pill. And so people got confused when they came in. I take credit for that. That's the only thing I've taken credit for the Food and Drug Administration. But no, it's, yeah, so we would rehab houses. The point is to get them in safe and decent condition and encourage people in the neighborhood to buy them. It's particularly challenging. The incomes in Franklinton are pretty low, and it's very difficult for people to get mortgages, even at a greatly subsidized rate. And so that's kind of where art came in for us. We were thinking, you know, we would love to attract more people to the neighborhood. The original population of Franklinton at its peak was like 30,000 people. Currently, it's somewhere around 9,000. So that tells you a lot about the vacant lots and a lot of the vacant houses. Now we're certainly on an uptick. But for years, it just stagnated in population and in income and real estate value. The real challenge in the neighborhood is being able to get a loan to build something that's not going to be worth as much as you spent to build it. So there's a development gap there, and that's what we did. We filled the gap. We tried to help people in the neighborhood get better on their feet, better economically. And to be able to get mortgages, but we also try to attract new people from the outside to sort of repopulate. And that's where the arts came in, because we thought artists could fit our sort of demographic pretty well as far as income goes, and just make it more exciting and help change that reputation.
Mm. So if somebody's listening and saying, you know, I would love to get involved with the Walnut Street Project, how do they find you outside of going to the bar?
They should go to the bar. Go to the bar and find me. That's all you have to do. I don't have a good answer for that. We're not a nonprofit. You know, I could say come volunteer, but I don't want to take volunteers away from other organizations that need them more than I do. We have a great crew. I mean, I've hired one person, and his name is Justin Ryan. He's my director of operations, and he set up the business, and it's going great. I mean, he's really a stellar bar creator and operator. And you know, I would love to have people help, but there's going to be things to do. Just I don't know what they are just yet. Put it that way.
Maybe somebody's like, you know what? I have an idea for a business. I'd like to start. Oh,
in that case, absolutely. If you, you know, we'd like to talk to people. We'd like to hear ideas. We'd like to find tenants for our spaces that would fit sort of our vibe, if you will. And yeah, I'm all ears. You know, all you gotta do is come down to Sweeney's Walnut Street Tavern, 500 West Walnut Street. Easy to find once you found it, and
you'll be there.
I'll be there. We're a records bar, by the way. We're a vinyl bar, so we ask people when on their first visit to bring a record to donate. We have a huge case built by my friend Matt Hatcher over at the formerly the Columbus Idea Foundry. And we can fill 2,000 records into that thing. So people are coming through the door, record in hand. We had our opening a week ago today. We've been open for 1 week, unlike Tony Paco, who's been there for 97 years or whatever he said, which is funny to me. But yeah, we've been around for 1 week as of today. And our opening was amazing. Like 300-something people showed up probably. Former Mayor Coleman was there, you know, a lot of other people. And people came with records. And so the idea is you donate a record to us. It's still your record. It's just living at our bar. And so when you go there, you not only do you know for a fact that there, or for sure that there's a record there that you love, at least one, probably way more than that, but you also feel some ownership in the place. I want this to feel like everybody's bar. I want this to feel, and for that reason, I hired mostly friends and people of Franklinton to do the work. We used local material, even some of that. We took out a floor, like bedroom floor where my bedroom was, took the floor out completely. So there's this loft experience in the front. Mm. And we reused every piece of wood we took out, reused somewhere else. Like the bar top is made of the flooring.
Oh, that's neat.
My friend Zach Hankel built that, and it's amazing.
That was Jim Sweeney, the owner of Sweeney's Walnut Street Tavern. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks. Urban Sprawl this weekend.
Yeah, I'll have to come by, bring a record.
Yes, bring one for sure.
Coming up, we're talking with a teen business entrepreneur on a mission to help. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Tolerio Watkins II was just 7 years old when he started his business, Tiger Mushroom Farms, and a dream of pursuing food justice took root. Today, Tolerio is a high school student, and he joins me from a classroom at his high school where he's taking a short break. Welcome to All Sides.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So, what on earth made you want to start a food business when you were seven?
So what made me want to start my business was my very first Cub Scout meeting. We grew crabgrass and basil, and that was interesting to me because not only was I able to grow my own food, my mom had put it on a pizza, and that allowed me to be able to eat my own food as well. So that got me interested in agriculture and wanting to grow stuff. But my parents didn't know what to get or know what kind of equipment they were supposed to buy me in order to, you know, pursue my passion for growing food.
They didn't garden.
Exactly. And so they were trying to figure out what could we grow in Ohio in the winter. And so I came up with the idea after I read a book at school, that mushrooms can grow in the dark. It was a book about mushrooms, and I brought the idea up to my parents, and they were curious and skeptical, obviously, because they didn't know what mushrooms were. They hid it in my food, but besides that, they didn't know how to grow mushrooms. So we had done a bunch of research. We had looked up different ways to grow mushrooms, and we stumbled upon a website called Back to the Roots. And we bought our first mushroom kit from them. And after I grew my first mushroom, we started researching different ways to grow mushrooms. And eventually, we had too many mushrooms to eat. And so we decided to sell them at farmers markets. And because I was a Tiger Scout when I started the business, I named the business Tiger Mushroom Farms.
And now you're 16. How has the business grown and changed?
It's grown a lot. It has grown a lot. We went from just doing farmers markets to sell in like the early years, selling to grocery stores, restaurants, different places, and just like doing different deliveries. Now we're mostly focused on our seasoning because I'm trying to start a seasoning line. I'm trying to get it into online stores. And then also focusing more on the nonprofit, the Garnica Project. And so I can help the community a lot more and just a lot more effectively.
Yeah, let's talk about that. In 2020, you started a nonprofit called the Garnica Project. What does it do? I mean, you started this kind of in the middle of the pandemic.
Well, the Garnica Project I started in about March of 2020.
Oh, so right before lockdown.
Yes. And it got finalized in March 2020. It was already an idea that we had tried to implement earlier on, but the paperwork got finalized for it in March 2020. But the main goal for the Garnica Project was to help end childhood hunger and to encourage kids to eat healthier. So I've been doing that by going to different schools, talking about all the things that we're doing, trying to encourage as many kids as possible into growing it into agriculture. I've gone to schools. I've helped kids grow out of I went to a school and I helped them with soil. I gave them soil, seeds, and watering cans, and I helped them make their own school garden.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and I've also done microgreen seed kits so that it can inspire kids in the community to want to grow something by growing microgreens for the first time.
Yeah, you've also distributed 150 mushroom kits to elementary school students, letting them grow their own mushrooms.
Yes, yes. I'm trying to just get a lot of outreach out in the community so then a lot of kids and a lot of people know that there is another opportunity out there besides, you know, anything else. But agriculture is also just a big part of culture in like general, as well as just a big part of our future.
I love that it's kind of in a way sparking or potentially sparking that passion that first grabbed you when you grew your first set of spices.
Yeah.
And who knows, maybe there's a kid who got one of the kits and is now obsessed with gardening somewhere, just like you've become. The Garden Club Project has also distributed 2,000 pounds of fresh produce. That is not an amount to sneeze at. That is a lot of fresh fruits and veggies.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I got to ask, you are 16. What are you thinking about as a college major? What do you want to do next with all of this?
I'm actually planning on going into agricultural engineering and then computer engineering at OSU. Oh. I want to try to implement technology into agriculture and make it more effective early on so for the future.
They have a great agricultural program. I think that'll be a really good fit.
Yeah.
So you've also participated in the Disney Dreamers Academy. What was that? How did you get in and what was that like?
The Disney Dreamers Academy was really fun. I got to meet a lot of cool people and learn a lot of different like experiences from all over America. A lot of people came in and a lot of people had their own ideas and their own ways of doing things. And I got to see that, and I got to see the world from a different perspective through other people's eyes. So that was extremely fun to do. We all got in by like writing like an essay about just what we did, and we had to find like our favorite Disney character. Mine was Spider-Man.
Good
and
choice.
so and so we were all just having a lot of fun, and we were able to do just a lot of things, especially make new friends and network.
That's really cool. And Damon John from Shark Tank was at that event and even invited you onto the show.
Yes, he invited me out, and I got to see the backstage part of the show. I was invited like in front of the camera, but I didn't. He did allow me to sit in his chair, so that was
That's
fun.
really neat. That's fun. So, I guess how big is your garden today?
Right now, we have an acre of land that we're currently growing on. We have a high tunnel that's set up. And we're planning on putting fruit into it so that we can extend seasons longer for other produce. And then we also do have produce in the ground right now. We have tomatoes, cucumbers, basil. And that's like the main three that we have in the ground right now so that we can donate that produce to local food banks.
Are you still selling at farmers markets through Tiger Mushroom Farms?
Yes, we do pop-up markets from time to time. Right now we have like a lot of stuff that we're trying to put together, so we're really just doing like pop-up markets every now and again. But we do plan on trying to get back out into farmers markets a lot more steadily, just as trying to slow it down a little bit.
Yeah, because you said you're working on a spice company. Do you have a name for that one yet?
Well, the spice is from Tiger Mushroom Farms, so I think the spice itself is called the shiitake onion soup mix,
Ooh, that sounds
and
good.
yeah, and so I'm trying to get the varieties out, like lavender, barbecue, Italian, and different varieties out into like an online store or on my website.
What is your website for people that are like, I would like to buy that soup mix?
The website is tigermushroomfarms.com.
And if somebody is interested in the Garden Club project and wants to support you in that way, how do we find you there?
The Garden Club Project .com as well is a website for the Garden Club Project as well, and my Instagram and socials should be on the website as well.
Great. Also, I understand that Taco Bell flew you out to your headquarters at one point. How did you end up with Taco Bell?
And so Taco Bell, they have a ambassador accelerator program or ambition accelerator program, sorry. And so basically they take 50 kids and they teach them about our entrepreneurship, leadership, how to be more how to be better at networking, helping people out, mentoring them and different stuff. We went to like a world cafe where we were able to sit down and talk to people who are a part of Taco Bell team, and they told us different ways to help our businesses or help our nonprofits and just to be more effective entrepreneurs. And so it was very insightful and very motivational as well.
You've had a lot of amazing opportunities in the last decade of your life. It's pretty incredible.
Thank you. Yes, it is.
Do you ever look back and are just sort of stunned that it's all developed out of a Boy Scout meeting?
Yeah, I didn't actually expect this to be this big or snowball into this big of a thing, but I am glad it did because I got to see all the different experiences, and that's all thanks to doing Boy Scouts and Boy Scouts just being there in my life.
Are you still in Boy Scouts?
Yes, I am.
You're working on that Eagle Scout, aren't you? Or
I
working
am.
on.
I'm trying to get there.
Why do you think it's so important to connect children with gardening?
I think it's important because I see agriculture as a big thing in our future, as well as the fact that it is just something that can connect us to our culture and to nature just a lot more. And that's always super important, especially just for the happiness and overall well-being of people. And also it helps the environment a lot. And so it's just extremely important all around for people, for the environment, and just for the economy in the future.
Do you think it's changed the way that you and your family eat?
I would say yes. We take a lot of time looking at calories and, like, you know, thinking non-GMO foods and everything like that. It kind of did change the way we think and about the food that we eat and, like, where it came from. Every time we go to restaurants, we see mushrooms, like, oh, I wonder where they got those from.
You might talk to the manager, be like, you know, I have a business in case you're looking. My final question for you is, when you were 11, you told an interviewer that your goal was to be president of the United States one day. I gotta ask, is that still an aspiration?
I would like to be in, like, a leadership position. However, I guess I've kind of toned it down from president. But be in a leadership position, probably. Leader in, like, agricultural industries probably is my main goal. We'll see about president later on in the future.
Never say never. That was Talerio Watkins II, owner of Tiger Mushroom Farms. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to Fascinating Ohio on All Sides, right here on 89.7 NPR News.